Good evening. My name is Catherine McNamara, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event, What Voters Need to Know: Implications for International Policy. At the October 8th presidential debate in Nashville, Tennessee, voters questioned Senator John McCain and Senator Barack Obama about Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Russia, Israel, and Iran. Despite the focus of this debate, a recent CNN poll indicates that 63% of Americans are unable to find Iraq on a map, 75% are unable to find Iran or Israel, and 88% are unable to find Afghanistan. Clearly, although interest and concern about the United States foreign policy are widespread, there's much confusion in the electorate about this important topic. Tonight's panel of Dickinson professors will examine U.S. foreign policy to help provide a deeper understanding of the relevant issues. The panel includes Neil Diamant, Associate Professor of Asian Law and Society, Ed Webb, Assistant Professor of Political Science and International Studies, Tony Williams, the Francis W. DeSario Chair for Strategic Intelligence at the United States Army War College and Adjunct Faculty in Political Science at Dickinson College, Christine Mitchell, Assistant Professor of Political Science and International Studies, and Neil Leary, Director of Environmental and Sustainability Education. Russ Bova, Professor of Political Science and International Studies, will moderate. At this time, I'd like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Please note that student representatives from the College Democrats and College Republicans will ask questions of the panelists prior to a general question and answer session. Because this program is being taped, and out of courtesy to those who are hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question. Following the program, all are invited to a reception. Refreshments are being provided by the Central Pennsylvania Alumni Club. Now, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Thank you, Catherine. 1 week from tonight, we'll all be, or many of us will be, sitting around our television sets watching the reports of the election results coming in. Maybe a few hours into the night, we'll have an idea of where the election will be going. But whoever wins the presidency next Tuesday, the foreign policy challenges that he and his administration will face seem, from my perspective, to be quite daunting. Consider just some of what will be on the next president's plate come Inauguration Day next January. First of all, we've got two hot wars underway. One in Iraq, which has been raging for 5+ years, and even its most ardent and optimistic supporters argue that it will be some time before we can extricate ourselves from that conflict. We have another war taking place in Afghanistan, where we've been fighting even longer, and where almost every observer suggests that the situation is getting more problematic by the week. We have at least two serious threats of nuclear proliferation in North Korea and Iran to deal with. In the Iranian case in particular, the United States and the international community have seemed impotent to do much of anything about it. And in both cases, the risk of such proliferation is such that it could potentially lead to destabilizing regional arms races. We have growing evidence of instability and a brewing problem in another country in the region, in Pakistan, a country that already has nuclear weapons and whose regions in the border with Afghanistan are home to militants and, some argue, terrorists, perhaps engaged in efforts to destabilize other countries in the region. We have a resurgent Russia that's considerably less democratic and considerably more willing to assert itself, as it did this past summer in Georgia, in ways deemed contrary to American interests and American preferences. We have the emergence of China, which incredibly has been virtually ignored in much of the debate over the course of the recent months of the presidential election, which is increasingly an economic force in the world, on which the United States is becoming increasingly financially dependent, and a country whose soft power and hard power may very well be on the ascendant. And of course, we have the continuing problem of energy dependence, which if you pump gas in your car recently, seems maybe like less of a problem as the prices drop fairly rapidly in the course of the last few weeks. But the dependence is real, it's there, and in fact, the lowering of prices may make it even more difficult to marshal the political support to do anything serious about it. If those challenges, and there are many others, you know, I haven't mentioned the perennial problems of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, challenges from Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and a host of other things I could easily add to the list if we chose to do so. But if that list, even that short list I gave you, seems daunting enough, consider we face all those problems at a time when we're in the midst of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, when the stock market, today aside, is in free fall, an economy that's bleeding jobs and that seems headed for a long, potentially deep recession, enormous budget deficits with the potential to get far worse given the spiraling cost of the financial bailout, to say nothing of the looming challenge of financing government entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. And finally, an infrastructure, which is crumbling in a healthcare system in disarray. So we have a combination of global challenges coupled with economic challenges at home, and you put them together, and it seems to me at least that while we've always faced challenges, you know, you think back to the Cold War days and dealing with the Soviet threat and Cuban Missile Crises, and you know, if you go back further, Berlin Airlifts, challenges in foreign policy are nothing new, but what seems to me different about the current situation is that we face them at a time when the future of America's economic position and global hegemony seems to be in some doubt. Well, on that series of optimistic notes, I'm going to turn the discussion over to our panelists. We have an interesting group tonight who bring to the table expertise in a variety of different areas. We have experts on China, on Europe, on the Middle East, on international terrorism in Russia, as well as on global environmental problems. What I've asked each of the panelists to do is as follows, and this is almost an impossible assignment, but to take somewhere between 6 to 7 minutes, right, to say a few provocative things or to give us a little bit of a sense of how they see the challenges facing American foreign policy and how they see the challenges facing the president-elect, whoever he ends up being, and to simply to get you thinking about the issues that this president will face come January of next year. So 6 to 7 minutes apiece, about 40 minutes of presentation by the panel. And then what we're going to do is give opportunity to representatives from the Dickinson College Democrats and the College Republicans to ask a couple of questions apiece of the panel, and panel members, multiple panel members may choose to respond to those questions. And then finally, we'll open it up to the audience. And when we open it up to the audience, we are inviting both questions for the panel or brief, you know, 60-second, 90-second comments if you feel that there is something you want to add that the panel really has not addressed. And we'll probably go for maybe 75 to 90 minutes all told. Catherine did a nice job of introducing the particulars of each of the panelists. Let me just say that our first speaker is, now is going to be Professor Neil Diamant, whose expertise is on China and East Asia.
Thanks, Russ. Can you put it on for a sec? Okay. I've been told I only have between 5 and 7 minutes, and I've prepared something pretty hokey. What you'll see here is basically a challenge per minute. So I have, I think, 5 or 6 challenges, and I'll try to keep it to a minute and a minute and a half per challenge. You know, after Russ's introduction, I felt, well, maybe now would be a good time to move to China. You know, just kidding, but, you know, The problems are quite serious, and I think China does have somewhat of a difficult position also. The United States is not the only country with significant problems. Let me get to the first one here, if I can get this working. Just to give you some orientation of where China is on the map. if you didn't know, China shares more borders than any other country in the world. And this often proves problematic, has proven problematic historically, and even now, in more contemporary period, China is surrounded by countries which present challenges to it and to the United States from North Korea over here, India, Pakistan, and Taiwan down there. Obviously, China is large. It cannot be ignored. And one of the odd things about this recent campaign is how little China has been mentioned. It's very unusual and kind of distressful. So the first challenge that I thought of, and this is something that I urge my students not to do, which is try to predict the future. But, you know, given the title of the panel, it was kind of inevitable. China does have a different political system to ours. It is not totalitarian like, say, Stalin, Stalin's Russia or Nazi Germany, but it is a different regime type. And, you know, for most states, this is not a problem. It is not a problem for Iran that China is authoritarian. However, it is a problem for the United States because one of the staples of U.S. foreign policy has been to spread democracy. Elections, rule of law, and so forth. And China is this big, important country that has apparently no inclination to adopt democracy as its political system. And this raises the question, should the next president try to spread democracy in a country like China? Is it in the United States' best interest to promote elections in a country that has 1.3 billion people? Or should the United States focus more on issues of political stability? Democracy can be, and often has been, destabilizing. So should we, or should the next president, focus on promoting democracy for the masses, or stability? And this is often a problem because authoritarian regimes do tend to commit certain violations, most notably in the area of human rights. What will be the proper response to violations in human rights? Should we, you know, issue a white paper, a condemnation of China, if that happens? This goes to the larger question of how the United States will deal with what seems to be a growing family of countries, which might be called authoritarian capitalists, and one could include Russia in this also, countries that have adopted capitalism but are very wary of democracy. And I think there are many countries that see China and and Russia as potential models for their own political development rather than the United States. So there's a big question out there of how we deal with regime types that we do not like, which we might have moral objections to, but which have clout and significance in international affairs. Number two. This goes directly to the issue of leverage and how much leverage the next U.S. president will have in managing foreign policy and affairs of state. It also connects directly to the human rights issue, which I raised earlier. To the extent that the next president sees it appropriate to criticize China on the basis of its human rights abuses, say, this might invoke a response on part of the Chinese government. They do have power to withdraw funds. They can destabilize our markets if they choose to do this. And the question for the next U.S. president is, how far can we go? Criticizing China, stating our policy about democracy so forthrightly if China does have a lot of economic leverage over this. We are a debtor nation, and debtor nations don't have as much clout as countries that have very fiscal, healthy fiscal records. The United States model is also in question in light of this financial crisis. We have been preaching deregulation, preaching the significance, the almost the moral rightness of free markets over the last decade or so or more. Other countries see what is happening here. They see what is happening with banks. They see what is happening with outflows of capital from stock markets. Will we be able to promote our vision of a good economy if the situation continues? This slide highlights the significance of interdependence in the world economy and the difficulty in adopting any sort of unilateralist policy, whether it's regarding war or economic policy. Am I keeping to 1 minute per slide, roughly?
Pretty close.
China is out there. This is no longer the 1950s or even the 1960s when China was pretty much self-contained in Asia. It did not have extensive foreign relations that posed certainly a challenge or a direct threat to the primacy of the United States in many areas of the world. I should point out that China's growing reach is not driven by ideology. They have no interest in promoting authoritarianism to these countries or any, you know, odd version of communism. This drive outward is primarily resource-driven. China's economy is booming. They need resources, minerals, oils, chemicals, you name it. And they are searching for markets worldwide for these resources. This has, of course, impact on our energy policy to the extent that we are highly dependent on any particular resource, and China is also competing for it. And I haven't mentioned India, which also is a competitor in this respect. We will have problems. So China has direct impact on our energy policies. Second, the United States has a PR problem. It is not well-liked in many areas of the world, and one could explain this by looking at, you know, the Iraq War, which was not well-received. The United States' tendency to say, you know, I'll use Yiddish here, you know, new, you know, shame on you, countries for, you know, committing some sort of violation of human rights or crimes or responses to riots and so forth. Many countries do not like this sort of meddling into affairs that they consider in the realm of their sovereign authority. Third, the financial crisis. As I mentioned earlier, in the press, it is generally kind of underreported the impact this has on how other countries perceive us. But I do think that our credibility has suffered a great deal in how how the crisis has unfolded and our response to it. Did I miss one? Yeah, okay. This sort of a little bit seems to contradict my first slide about authoritarianism. China is an authoritarian state. However, it is a highly fractured one. It has great difficulty implementing laws that it has passed, it has legislated and ratified. It is certainly not monolithic in the sense that whatever Beijing says, everybody sort of walks in lockstep after that. Take, for example, intellectual property, which is a concern for companies like Microsoft, Walt Disney, many other companies in the United States. China has approved intellectual property rights. It does protect it in law. However, when one travels throughout the provinces, one can easily buy, you know, High School Musical 3, you know, is right there on the streets of Shanghai. How will the next president deal with a country that signs treaties but has very limited capacity in enforcing them? Do we want to crack down on these supposed violations when the Chinese government itself often does not have the power to respond to that? There will be more protests in China. It is very difficult for the Chinese government to maintain control in light of growing inequalities. Should the United States government express sympathy with protesters who are demanding, say, back wages or demanding more rights? Or should the United States be more sympathetic to the government, which, after all, does have to maintain, you know, authority over 1.3 billion people? It's different when you're governing 1.3 billion people as opposed to 250 million people. Numbers matter here. So it will be a challenge, given our ideals of, you know, promote freedom, democracy, rights, dealing with a country like China that has difficulty enforcing all of these. Number five. China lives in a very difficult neighborhood. in terms of the stability of regimes surrounding it. Taiwan is much less of a problem than it used to be. I don't see any potential conflict leading to war. However, North Korea is a highly problematic country, as we all know. We don't know really what's happening there. We don't know the state of its leadership. Is he healthy? Is he not healthy? The situation with nuclear weapons is also very opaque. Pakistan also, a highly unstable country. What will happen in the event of mass protests against the government there? China, by contrast, seems quite rational and stable by comparison. China can help us. China does have leverage over North Korea and does have leverage over Pakistan. At the same time, to the extent that we want China to use its leverage, what price will we have to pay for it? Right? It does not come free. If we want China to influence North Korea, China will insist on some quid pro quo from the United States. So managing these relationships will be quite difficult.
Neil, you're a little bit over, so can you...
I have the last one right here. This is the final challenge. It's a Chinese character. The next U.S. president should hopefully try to encourage American students to learn more about China, more about Chinese and Hindi and these other important countries, so that, you know, 8-10 years' time, American students will know what this character means. Anybody know what it means? The end. So I'll stop with that.
Thank you, Neil. Our next speaker will be Professor Christine Mitchell, who is an expert on Europe.
Thank you. So Russ, Professor Bova started us off with this laundry list of challenges, problems, if you will, facing the United States, facing the next American president. Interestingly, not one of these came from Europe, which is the area that I'm going to talk about. So why do we talk about Europe on a panel of foreign policy challenges and opportunities? Well, there are both challenges and opportunities. Europe has been, at least for the last 6-7 decades, and I would argue actually going much farther back, America's oldest, America's most important allies in addressing global issues. And that transatlantic relationship has come under real strains and tensions under the Bush administration, and especially in the last 5 years. So I'd like to take a few minutes here, my 6 or 7 minutes I hear I'm up to now, to talk about the nature of those challenges, what are the sources of these conflicts, and what, if anything, is going to change under a new president once we move past this administration. So if we want to think about the sources of these tensions, I think you get a really different view depending on which side of the Atlantic you're sitting on. It only makes sense. Americans view Europeans as the source of the problem, and Europeans view Americans as the source of the problem. I'm going to state what I think is probably uncontroversially the Bush administration's view of the source of transatlantic tensions, and that is that Europe fundamentally drags its feet. It either can't, when we talk about Europe as a collection of states, the EU, it either can't or it won't deal effectively with the global issues that are most pressing, certainly to the United States, and probably to the international community more broadly. And as a result, there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of talk, and there's very little action. And understanding something about the nature of decision-making in this complex new entity of the European Union goes some way to contextualizing that. I'll leave that somewhat technical discussion aside for now and just say that there's some truth to this claim. The Bush administration isn't completely wrong in being skeptical of the ability of Europe to act in important ways on pressing problems. What is maybe more problematic has been the interpretation of what the U.S. should do to respond to that, which has been to shoulder the burden alone. the United States' view of its mission under the last president, under the current president, for another couple of months, has been that the United States bears the responsibility for acting to resolve the foreign policy problems that it faces, that the international community faces. So this includes things like international terrorism, and we can think about the United States' role in spearheading the war on terrorism, as it's called. We can think of weapons of mass destruction and the United States' efforts to lead the campaign in Iraq to address the issue of weapons of mass destruction there. We can think of nuclear proliferation. North Korea is one area, but Iran is probably the more important one. How should the world act to address this challenge? Well, the American the White House looks at Europe and says, you know, you talk a lot about it, but you don't do anything. And the United States is the only actor out there able and, more importantly, willing to deal with these issues head on. So this is the source of tensions in the transatlantic relationship from the American side, or certainly from the point of view of the White House. Well, what does this look like from the other side of the Atlantic? The European view is that, yes, the United States acts, but how is it acting? And the view, I think, is that for Europeans, the United States is acting both too hastily, without sort of due process, without enough consideration of alternatives and diplomatic efforts and economic sanctions. And perhaps even more problematically, the United States is acting too unilaterally. It's working too much on its own, without international institutions, without reliance on its traditional and new allies. The most obvious point that we can all think of, I think, straight off the bat here is with Iraq, right? The American-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 without the legitimacy of a UN mandate. But Europeans criticize other elements of the U.S.'s what we might call go-it-alone policy. Iraq is not the only dividing point between Europeans and Americans, although it's a highly visible one. So what are some other elements of this go-it-alone policy? We can look at issues like the United States' failure to ratify the Kyoto Protocol, seen as an abdication of leadership not only by Europeans, by much of the world. The United States' failure to take a decisive leadership position on global climate change, on environmental issues that are hugely important to large numbers of the world's population. The United States' failure to sign on to the convention establishing the International Criminal Court, the ICC, a contentious issue with our European allies and beyond Europe as well. Perhaps more significantly, elements of this go-it-alone policy that are criticized by Europeans in particular is the United States' general conduct, or what they might actually call misconduct, of the American-led war on terror. And I'll point out just a couple of things here. I know there are others that will talk about that in more detail. But the areas that have been particularly galling to Europeans have been the expansion of the theater of that war, moving from Afghanistan and the search for al-Qaeda networks and for Osama bin Laden to Iraq and the somewhat misguided search for weapons of mass destruction. To many people, this was a big mistake. Europeans also take issue with the United States' treatment of prisoners as a part of this war on terror. And here we can think, of course, of the Abu Ghraib scandal, the enhanced interrogation techniques that are used in Guantanamo with prisoners, and an extraordinary rendition of prisoners to third countries for interrogation. So there are lots of elements when we look at the European view of the sources of these transatlantic tensions, these conflicts, about why that happens and in what ways the U.S. is to blame. Both sides are sort of talking past one another. Each side sees the other as the root of the conflict. So how much of this is going to change? How much of this is a product of the Bush administration and will disappear when that administration comes to an end? There's reason for optimism here, and there's some reason. Of course, I'm an academic. I'm going to say there's both sides, right? There's some reasons for to suspect that some of these tensions will continue even after a new presidency is installed in office. In the short term, I think the next president, whether this is a Democrat or a Republican, is going to have a huge premium of goodwill in European capitals simply by virtue of not being George W. Bush. And that's a bit sad to say, but I think it's honest as well. And that goes not just for leaders in European capitals, but for the underlying public as well. I was just looking at a recently released Gallup opinion poll, public opinions of European populations, approval ratings for U.S. leadership. These range from a whopping high of 30% of Poles who agree that American leadership is something worthy of approval, down to 8% of Austrians. Most states were in there around 15-20% approval ratings. So a lot of Europeans are going to be happy to see a new administration, an administration that might do things differently. So is a new administration going to do things differently? There are some reasons for optimism here. There are some reasons to think that transatlantic relationship will smooth out a little bit when somebody new comes to office. One of those reasons is that both of the contenders for office here hold views on a lot of areas that are more closely aligned with what's popular in Europe. So we can think of both candidates, both Senator McCain, Senator Obama, have publicly declared their desire to close Guantanamo, something that's also popular and called for in Europe. Both candidates are pushing for a move to firmly renounce the use of terror, the use of torture in the war on terror. Something again that resonates in European capitals. Both candidates are firmly behind a stronger U.S. leadership position in tackling global climate change, global warming, greenhouse emissions. So stronger leadership role on environmental issues. These are all things that are music to the ears of many Europeans, both in leadership positions and ordinary folks on the street. We should also add that there have been some changes on the European side. The French and British governments back in 2002 were the fiercest critics of American policy with regard to Iraq. There are new political leaders in both of those countries, both of which are much more pro-American than their predecessors. So there have been changes on both sides. And I think these all give us reason to be optimistic about the possibility for United States and European countries to really work with one another to address a lot of these issues that we're going to hear about tonight. But I want to point out two reasons for maybe some continued friction. There's no relationship between states in the world that is perfectly harmonious and unproblematic. So we shouldn't expect that of this relationship either. But what are likely to be the sources of friction facing the new president as he takes office? First thing is that the next American president, again, whether Democrat or Republican, is likely to make some moves away from unilateralism, but the result is going to be that person is going to ask more of our European allies, and that's something that is going to be difficult for European states and for the European Union collectively to deal with in many cases. Certainly, an American president will want to see more diplomatic engagement from European states as American military presence diminishes, perhaps over the short term, perhaps over the longer term, in Iraq. Perhaps more problematically, an American president is likely to ask for more troops from European states as a part of this NATO mission to Afghanistan. There have been European troops engaged since the very beginning, since 2001. But many of those troops have restrictions placed on them by their home governments. They're placed in support roles, not on frontline combat. There are geographical restrictions. The next American president is likely to push for not only more troops but fewer restrictions. That's going to be a hard promise to deliver on, given the domestic climate in some of these countries. So there will be still sources of conflict there. Second thing, right, we'll ask, the American president will ask for more. At the same time, there are still differences of opinion that will outlive the passing of the Bush presidency. And I'll give you just one example, one that I think we'll have to deal with sooner rather than later, which is Iran. there's a real consensus in European capitals against the use of force, military force, to deal with the problem of nuclear proliferation in Iran. Neither Senator McCain nor Senator Obama has definitively removed the use of force as a policy option for the United States. There will be continued diplomacy. There will be continued sanctions. But if it comes to the use of force, this will be a major policy rift between the two sides of the Atlantic. I think I'll just wrap it up here. Despite these continued tensions, right, there are signs for optimism. And I want to point out the bigger underlying trajectory, which is that there are shared interests and a lot of shared interests between the United States and Europe. It's hard to talk about Europe as one country. It's not one country. There are differences of opinion here. But in terms of dealing with environmental issues, the addressing global terrorism, and certainly spreading democracy, which Professor Diamant just spoke about, these are all shared interests, shared values on both sides of the Atlantic. So there are both some opportunities here as well as some potential sources of future conflict.
Thanks, Christine. Our next speaker is Professor Ed Webb, whose expertise is in the Middle East.
Not in technology.
Aren't you a Willoughby fellow?
Yeah. This worked just now.
Where's our tech person?
Up there, I think. Apparently our projector is asleep.
He's coming down.
Probably a new battery.
Didn't CIA do it? Probably. While our tech person is coming down, I'll say my expertise is in the Middle East, apparently. There are no Middle East experts. It's too big for anyone to be an expert in the whole thing. When we get the image up here, then hopefully you'll see what I'm going to do. I'm going to take you on a tour, I hope, of some of the spots in which we have challenges ahead. But there's no way, even if I had half an hour, that I would be able to give you anything like a comprehensive tour of the problems. All right, our map is not yet up. So one thing you've heard so far is that the Middle East has come up in everybody's talk, right? The introduction, Catherine, I think, mentioned a few things. We've ended Christine's thing with Iran. We talked about Pakistan, which for some is included in the Greater Middle East. Certainly Afghanistan is often included. Many of the issues facing the next administration will be, one way or another, centered on the Middle East. And they're mostly not going to be resolved over the life of the next administration, whichever it is. Middle East has been a source of problems for imperial powers for a long time, which is not to say that the U.S. is necessarily an imperial power, but outside powers involved in the Middle East have found it complicated, to say the least. All right, I think our technology is waking up. Possibly. Yes? No? Yes? Maybe.
One moment.
All right. So, how many people can find Baghdad on the map?
There you go.
Good. All right. Excellent. We have the power. Okay. I'm going to be using Google Earth, which is a great technology. You don't need anything special. Download this, put this on your computers, play with it. Lots of fun for the whole family. This is perhaps the Middle East. How you define it varies. But anyway, we're going to start actually where Christine ended her presentation, mm-hmm. which is in Austria, where U.S. Is not thought very highly of, apparently. And the reason we're starting here is there are two key institutions that we need to pay attention to. One is OPEC. There's the headquarters. OPEC is a very interesting collection of countries. It includes some good friends of the United States, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. It includes some less good friends of the United States, such as Venezuela and Iran. Clearly, though, a very important institution, energy security is going to be a key issue for the next administration, no question. Now, OPEC is not necessarily as powerful as it might sometimes appear. This is the recent decision, the 150th meeting of OPEC, where they decide to cut production in order to raise the price of oil. As we see, it actually did not have much effect. OPEC has ways of, it's a cartel, they manipulate the market, they try and keep the price somewhere. But OPEC, like the rest of us, seems to be actually at the mercy of the markets. Nevertheless, they do have an impact. And being that special club that it is, with this mixture of friends and non-friends of the United States, need handling with care. Now, Vienna is not just OPEC. If we zoom across town, we find, in a very pleasant wooded area of the town, another institution very important for the next administration. This is the International Atomic Energy Agency. There we have it. The agency is not the only way the international community deals with proliferation problems, but it is one of the key tools we have for dealing with this. And obviously, as has been mentioned, North Korea is a significant issue, but Iran is really the most pressing issue on the agenda of nuclear proliferation at the moment. If we flip forward here, and maybe we'll be able to get this up. Right. There's a mixed pattern of cooperation and non-cooperation between the Iranian government and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Dealing with Iran's proliferation attempts is got to be very high on the agenda, whoever comes to power. There's no particular answer about how to do this, and I'm certainly not going to make any policy recommendations tonight. But this has got to be very high up the agenda. It is not going away anytime soon. Iran, from their perspective, firstly makes the case that they need the energy, that this is peaceful energy development, and it's not a completely bogus case. They do have lots of oil and gas, but they actually have very high energy needs. It's a very high population in that country. They are developing. And they need to export quite a lot of their oil and gas, and they want to export more to earn foreign currency. So it's not a ridiculous argument that primarily they're interested in energy. But, of course, they're interested in weapons research. Living in the neighborhood they live in, who would not be, frankly? And so the question becomes how to manage that. The IAEA is one way, invading the country is another, and then there are lots of options in between. Whoever comes into office next has got to give some pretty serious thought to that and deal with it. Whoa, we're going on a nice dizzy ride here. Here we're actually still in Europe, technically, just. This is Silivri, which is in Turkey, just north of Istanbul. This is important at the moment for this reason. Turkey is going through what the Chinese would call interesting times in its internal politics. You have, since 2000 in power, you have a moderate Islamist party. You have lots of resistance to them from the secular, supposedly secular, government outside the official government. There's a sort of government within a government thing in Turkey. You have the armed forces, you have the courts, you have the secular establishment, the universities in particular, and the legal profession, resisting the elected government. Here you have a coup plot apparently averted and a trial going on. deep divisions in Turkish society about all sorts of questions about human rights, about democracy, and other things that really matter to the United States. Now, here's the thing. If you want democracy in Turkey, then you're actually going to back the elected government against the generals. On the other hand, Turkey is a key NATO ally, a key force for stability in the region, and a lot of that is based on the stabilizing effect of having the military there. And so relations with Turkey are complicated, but they are rather essential. Turkey most recently has come to notice, apart from this kind of thing, for its role in trying to intervene in the Middle East peace process between, in particular, mediating between Israel and Syria. Now, there aren't many states who could do that. Turkey is one of the few states that can actually effectively perform that kind of role. And so, to the extent that the United States thinks that's a good thing, then keeping Turkey on side and working with Turkey and Turkish stability are important things. Okay. Now we finally come to the Middle East itself, Middle East proper. This is the presidential palace compound in Damascus. Damascus, by the way, is an amazing city if you've ever got a chance to visit. Beautiful place. There should be lots of tourism to Syria. It's an amazing country. However, there is not a lot of tourism, of course, particularly Americans, and relations are not where one might hope they would be. The guy who lives there is a key figure in untangling a lot of the knots in the Middle East. The ruling family of Syria, it's a republic, but you know, it's one of these republics that you get in the Middle East sometimes where sons follow fathers into the presidency. Syria, obviously peace between Syria and Israel would be a key stabilizing factor in the region. Syria is also rather important in terms of flows of militants and money and all sorts of other nasty things across the border into Iraq, as we know recently because of an incident that happened. Let's go see where that happened. So if we head over to Iraq but actually stop en route down near the border here somewhere... we're not getting it. Somewhere out here in the desert. The borders, the border areas between Syria and Iraq are really difficult to police. Really very difficult to police. This whole region has a tradition, of course, of nomadism, along with cities. Cities and agriculture, you've got nomads. And a lot of these borders are rather meaningless, historically, to the tribes who live there, to the nomadic peoples who live there. And so borders between Iraq and Syria, Iraq and Jordan, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, out there in the desert, are very, very difficult to police indeed. Syria has been under pressure from the United States and others to crack down on that border as a way for militants to get into Iraq. Seem to have had some success, according to statements in the past year from U.S. military sources as well as... Secretary Rice. Nevertheless, it has been insufficient. And then we saw this raid on across the border for apparently four U.S. helicopters, a commando raid, Syrians reporting 8 civilian deaths, U.S. unofficial military sources being quoted in the media as saying that the target was a militant who has been facilitating infiltration of foreign fighters into Iraq. It's all a little hazy. The public diplomacy has gone a bit awry on this one. And the Syrians are understandably upset that their border's been violated and they've been invaded. Of course, Syria can't really respond. They can say, they can make protests at the United Nations. They can say, if you do this again, we'll respond with force. It seems rather unlikely. What they have done is close down the U.S. school and cultural center in Damascus. Which seems like a feeble gesture, although I know people who have their kids in that school are going to be inconvenienced considerably by this. But The key thing here is that it's not only upset the Syrians. This cross-border raid from Iraqi territory has also upset the Iraqis. So we should go to the Iraqi parliament, because the key thing about Iraq for the next administration is not whether to get out, but it's how to get out. And there doesn't seem to be any lack of consensus on that. The question is about timing, about details of agreements and those kind of things. It seems fairly clear now that the forces agreement, the basing agreement that the US has been asking for is not going to be passed before January 1st. It's not 100% certain, but it's looking pretty difficult if you look at the coalitions in the parliament and who's against it, and the decreasing numbers who actually support that agreement. So by the start of next year, before even the next president takes office, either there has to be a new UN mandate to cover the activities of US and other forces in Iraq, or there has to be some kind of agreement, but it won't be the one, apparently, that has been negotiated so far. That has to be the key focus for whoever's coming in. How to get out of Iraq in a way that is stable, sustainable, which leaves behind an Iraq that is not going to immediately fragment. And one key concern, of course, is that Iran's influence in Iraq since the invasion of 2003 has grown immensely. Iran has been immensely empowered by this, and so the question is how to get out of Iraq in a way that doesn't further enhance Iranian influence in the country and in the region. Last place we're going to on our tour is outside the Middle East that I generally talk about, but it's a key area. If we're thinking about the broader Middle East and if we're thinking about the issues, the security issues, this is where the action really is. Up here in the federally administered tribal areas, Fatah, the border area of Pakistan and Afghanistan, the Khyber Pass. The Brits had all sorts of trouble back there in the 19th century, and the trouble is still there today. This is, as I say, where the real action is going to be in terms of security and terrorism, as far as I can see, for the next administration, at which point I think Tony has a few things to say.
Thank you, Ed.
Do you want the map still up?
No.
Next speaker, Tony Williams, expert on international terrorism.
I'd like to start my comments by making the observation that virtually every international issue that you can imagine has the most serious domestic underpinnings. And one, President Obama, President McCain, President God cannot address any of these issues without taking into consideration the domestic underpinnings of each of them. I recall for your consideration the dictum of former Speaker of the House, Thomas Tip O'Neill, all politics are local. He wasn't just talking about politics in the House of Representatives of the U.S. Congress. I assure you, because I was privy to a conversation surrounding that particular statement. And O'Neill well understood that, first of all, that dictum is a double-edged sword, because for you, what is a foreign policy problem, at the other end of that pole is a domestic policy problem. But it is also a domestic policy problem at your end of the poll. Stalin asked Roosevelt, why do you hang on to the Lithuanian national gold reserves? Relative to your wealth, they are a paltry matter. And Roosevelt responded, much to Stalin's apparent befuddlement, if Molotov's remembrances are correct, because Lithuanians vote in America. And of course, to Stalin, that obviously was a bit of a puzzle because people voted in the Soviet Union the way Stalin chose for them to vote. But the point Roosevelt was getting at is that, and as Harry Truman learned so well in 1948, Lithuanians comprised a single-issue voting bloc in Pennsylvania and in Illinois. And a voting bloc that, while it wouldn't carry the state alone, when coupled with several other single-issue voting blocs, made the difference between winning or losing those electoral college votes. And virtually every foreign policy issue you can think of is attached at both ends of the poll to a domestic problem. Each of the speakers so far has mentioned domestic problems in their respective regions. Bashar Assad, not my favorite president, hereditary president is the way I like to refer to these people. But, you know, if I were trying to be 100% objective, which is a rare condition for me, I would at least observe that Bashar Assad heads a regime that is its primary support are Alawite Muslims, a minority in Syria. A well-armed, well-heeled, and well-organized minority. But his rule rests on being able to balance the Shia and Sunni Muslims in that country as well. Now, his father was somewhat more forceful than how he did that. He simply had the army surround a few villages and exterminate the demonstrators, meaning the entire village populations. But the point is that Assad has to be concerned with what is, from our perspective, a foreign policy issue. But from his perspective, it's a domestic issue, and it's a critical domestic issue. How he responds to it may determine whether his son is the next hereditary president or whether he's the last and short-lived hereditary president of Syria. And the European Union and its components, similar problems. Austria, a good example. There are lots of reasons why Austrians don't like us. Some of them, I think, fairly stated, a product of the current administration's policies. Some, a product of the fact that this is a European country that, through democracy, elected a Nazi to a neo-Nazi to national leadership. Not something that made them very popular in Washington and with the U.S. State Department, I would point out. The issue is not to criticize Austria. The issue is to point out over and over every one of these foreign policy issues that you look at. If you're going to look at them as just foreign policy issues, you are missing two-thirds of the problem, because that's only one-third of the problem. And you cannot solve them if you do not understand both domestic ends of that pipeline and take that into consideration. And that, by the way, is what makes life in the State Department and in the National Security Council both so miserable and so much fun at the same time. I would like to turn from that to an issue that I think gets short shrift in almost every discussion of international relations. And I point out to you how we've approached this problem so far. We've approached this issue so far the same way the U.S. government has historically approached this issue. It may come as a shock to you, but the United States government had nothing that even remotely resembled a national security strategy until the administration of George Herbert Bush, 41. And prior to that, there were lots of strategies. Most of them were discovered as policies were kludged together and people realized, gosh, this is a good strategy. And so we discovered it. And an argument can be made, for example, for that our most famous strategy, how to deal with the Cold War, we literally discovered as we stumbled through its early stages. That's not to criticize the people making it, but it is to point out that even today, despite the fact now that we've had a decade and a half of developing national security strategies, how many of you in this room have ever read the current U.S. national security strategy? I know, Zane, you've read it. That says something. You can get it on the White House website. It's there for you. If you write the government printing office, they will happily send you a multicolored copy for the cost of the postage. It's not a big document. I think the current one is about 25 pages. I may be off by a few pages, but not by much. Right? It is the national security strategy on which all the rest of your national security, of which international relations is the major part, all right, and DOD's budget is the other 70%. All of your international relations are based essentially on that national security strategy. You ought to be familiar with it. Haven't heard it mentioned once in the presidential debates. Not once. I haven't seen it mentioned in any of the paid advertisements that swamp my television these days. I'm not sure either candidate, this is not fair. I would hope that both candidates are aware of it and have read at least the last two. But I wouldn't bet a sizable, so maybe the change in my pocket, nothing beyond that, that they have. So why is it important? It is important because that government bureaucracy that executes your policy, and that's its job, and tries to assist the democratically elected policymakers who make the policy, that bureaucracy relies on this strategy as a guide. And when the policymakers themselves haven't read the guide, it really is awfully difficult to help them develop policy and to help them execute policy. What I'm really trying to describe to you is that policy too often is made in international affairs exactly as we have come to it here. My interest is the EU, energy, climate. And that's what I'm worried about. Well, but where does it fit in to the overall interest of the United States? What I would argue to you is that the number one issue facing either candidate when they are sworn in January of 2009 is to make sure that they have a competent team in place to draft a new national security strategy that prioritizes American interests and is tied in a calculus that relates to ways and means. The ability to actually execute elements of that strategy is absolutely critical to a sound and reasonable foreign policy or security policy, if you will. And I should warn you that I use the term security policy to incorporate foreign policy and other and foreign economic policy and so forth. The issue here is if you don't do this, then you will go on as a nation thinking that there is a war on terrorism and that it's somehow new and unique and that somehow Iraq was part of that war on terrorism before we invaded it. And then energy, after all, is just something we don't really have to worry too much about because, you know, we can buy it on the open market. And besides, all of you will be old people before we really suck up all the oil. And so it's your children's problem.
Tony, can I interrupt one second? We have a little problem because some of our student panelists have to leave at 8:30.
Fair enough.
So a little bit unfair to the last two speakers, but I'm going to try and hold you.
Let me just finish one minute, and I'll skip the other several items and we'll come back then. Because I think this is far more important than talking about, you know, the issues of terrorism. You can ask questions and I'll address those issues. The point I would like to close on then is to look at the issue of prioritizing interests. Are national values interests? Because it is this administration's contention that they are, this business of pursuing democracy. I'm not arguing that it's not, but I want to know when the debate was held publicly in which most of us said, yes, the pursuit of democratic institutions worldwide is a U.S. national interest high enough in the priority list that we should shed blood and treasure for it, and that we should sacrifice, for example, our energy security. Because those are the kinds of trade-offs that are involved in developing a national security strategy, and I don't remember that debate. Now, I might have slept through it, but I don't think so. Let me stop there because I got 100,000 more things I'd like to address.
And when the students ask the questions, there'll be opportunity perhaps. Our last speaker, Neil Leary, predicted that being the last speaker, he was going to get cut short of time. So, Neil, guess what? You were right. 6 to 7 minutes.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. less than 11 months after the new U.S. president takes office, a major international treaty on climate change is to be concluded at the 15th Conference of the Parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or what's called COP15. It's going to be held in Copenhagen in December of 2009. If that treaty is to be a credible and effective response that's capable of averting serious risks from climate change, it will necessarily set the U.S. and the rest of the world on a fundamentally different path for energy development. However optimistic or pessimistic you are about how cheaply we can do this, the technology availability, the feasibility, we're talking about a major changeover of shifting away from fossil energy to other sources of energy that would not be emitting carbon dioxide. Okay, this is no trivial thing to achieve. Okay, so this new president will have 11 months, that's not much time, to establish a vision for shaping this potentially momentous treaty, for developing support amongst various allies or hoped-for allies for the positions that the U.S. might take, and for negotiating a treaty that meets the objectives that that new administration might set for it. In addition, as Tony just said, there's always domestic ends of these issues, that this new president will need to be doing work at home in the United States to build support in Congress and in the U.S. public so that if a new treaty is agreed and is signed by that president, that it has some chance of being ratified. The last major treaty on climate change, the Kyoto Protocol, signed by President Clinton, with basically no real intention by him to ever submit it for ratification. He had not played the domestic end of this poll. He had not garnered support amongst the U.S. Congress for it to have any chance of being ratified, and so he never submitted it for ratification. Okay? So there's a great deal of work that'll need to be done by this new president on that aspect of it. The timetable is more challenging than 11 months may initially sound, as short as that is, that a draft text for this treaty needs to be negotiated and circulated to all parties of the Climate Change Convention no less than 6 months prior to the meeting in Copenhagen. So that means by May of 2009, we need a draft text. Okay. There's going to be initial groundwork for that being laid at the what's called COP14, the 14th Conference of the Parties. That will take place less than 5 weeks from today, less than 4 weeks from the election date. The U.S. will be sending an official negotiating team to that conference, which will be in Poznan, Poland. That negotiating team will receive its instructions and guidance from the current president, President George Bush. The president-elect will undoubtedly is probably already thinking about putting together an informal delegation to go to that conference to observe and take the pulse of what's going on there and get a sense of what may be feasible in the negotiations. But that's not much time to be acting on this. Why the rush? Why the urgency? Well, part of it is sort of the international sort of timeline that's been set up on this. The Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. That protocol, it's an international agreement that commits developed countries to reduce their emissions of greenhouse gases below 1990 levels by the time frame 2008 to 2012, so that in aggregate for the developed countries, about a 5% reduction. Different countries would have different commitments under that treaty. Developing countries have no commitments in that treaty for constraining, reducing their emissions of greenhouse gases. They do have requirements they have to meet for reporting and doing some other things under the treaty. The U.S., was already mentioned that having not ratified the Kyoto Protocol, really has been seen by much of the world as having abdicated responsibility and really missed a chance for leadership on this issue. That the Bush presidency, when it came in, chose not to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. In my view, the biggest problem there, though, was not having chosen not to ratify it. It was not having thought through an alternative strategy. At that stage, the rest of the parties to the Climate Change Convention with strong U.S. leadership could have been agreeable to some other approaches, but there just wasn't time or priority enough for the current president to move on that. If we fail to have a new agreement, a new treaty on climate change that will replace the Kyoto Protocol when it expires, that's going to be a major setback for progress on reversing the growth of emissions of greenhouse gases and bringing concentrations to a level that will prevent what's called dangerous interference with the climate system. If there's no agreement in Copenhagen, we're going to lose important time. That there's going to be, I would guess a few years would pass before we really are able to put together an international consensus on acting on this. In terms of the science, a great deal is often made about the uncertainty in the science, the various aspects of climate change and its consequences. And that has sort of slowed movement, progress on doing something about it. When you look, though, at the evolution of the science on this issue, there's something that's quite clear, is that at each stage, with each passing year, the way these uncertainties have been resolved have pointed in a direction that say that the climate is more sensitive to these emissions than previously thought. That Earth systems are more sensitive to changes in climate than previously thought. That the pace of changes is faster than what had been anticipated a decade ago. So we need to do something about this problem, and we are finding that time's running out to do something effective on it. So what are the major issues to be negotiated in this new treaty? One of them is what's being referred to as a shared vision for long-term cooperative action. Basically, it's setting goals for emissions of greenhouse gases over a long time horizon for the year 2050. Numbers that are being bandied about is suggesting that the goal should be set at about a 50% reduction in emissions of carbon dioxide below their 1990 level by the year 2050. Senator McCain's position on that is to target at least a 60% reduction by 2050. Obama, outdoing him a bit, his goal that he would set is an 80% reduction. These are dramatic, substantial changes to be pushing towards.
Can you wrap up in 1 minute, Neil?
Okay. All right. Skipping ahead.
We'll let you go first in 2012.
All right. This may not bode well for where this issue is going to land in the priorities for the next administration. When you look at the kinds of positions that both candidates have staked out on this, what you're going to find is both are fairly much in agreement. That both candidates have indicated that they would push for substantial reductions in emissions. They would both use the same approach, a cap-and-trade system that would use a market-based strategy for controlling emissions of greenhouse gases. So there's quite a bit of agreement in what they would do. There's some differences in the content, the specifics of it. To summarize briefly those differences that they follow fairly much along the lines of sort of the basic philosophies of these two candidates towards the role of government. That McCain's approach would tend to rely more on the private sector to make decisions about what investments to make, how to allocate resources, identifying which energy technologies make the most sense to pursue. Obama would tend towards a little bit more emphasis on government R&D programs and some more targeted kinds of proposals for specific technologies. But saying that, keep in mind that the main mechanism both of them are talking about is something that would have made environmental economists' heart just warm 20 years ago. They would have never thought you'd have both candidates pushing for a market-based emission permit trading system. Okay, so both the Democratic and Republican candidates are both saying that they will move in that direction. A big wild card in all of this is the what's going on in financial markets, the economic crisis. Will either of these candidates, if elected, how important will they make this? What priority will they give to this with the economic turmoil that's going on? One signal of what's going on in Europe on this, that they recently in the European Parliament had a vote on a resolution for a target for the year 2020 to reduce emissions by that date in Europe by 20% below the 1990 level. And there was a fair amount of speculation that this vote was taken on October 22nd. There's a lot of speculation that that vote, they would backtrack on this given what was going on in financial markets. And they voted by something like 460 to 120 to support that resolution. And sort of that sets sort of their bargaining position going into the negotiations.
Okay, thank you, Neil. Let's get right to it. College Republicans, we may only have time for one question from each side, so make it a good one.
Hi, my name is Phil Kiefer. I'm representing the College Republicans tonight. I want to thank, first of all, the Clark Forum for hosting this event, of course, all our panelists, and Professor Bova for moderating. The question we came up with was is aimed towards Professor Diamant and Professor Webb. And during the open house debate between Obama and McCain, there's a question posed about whether the presidential candidates would be willing, under certain circumstances, to launch a strike inside of Pakistan. And we know that there have been recent border clashes, and Professor Webb and Diamant talked about the instability in Pakistan, specifically along the border with Afghanistan. Obama said that he would be willing to launch such strikes under certain circumstances, and McCain took a much more conservative approach. Our question is, what would be the consequences on the stability of Pakistan if the United States were to launch some sort of strike and a public strike into Pakistan?
Thank you for pointing that in my direction.
60-second responses for me.
60-second response. Okay. Well, in some senses, the strikes are already going on. I mean, we know that CIA Predator drones are picking out targets. We know that there are various cross-border activities going on up there. I presume you're talking about some more major incursion. On the whole, I think that it would be very destabilizing for Pakistan to have a major incursion. I think, however, what seems to be the case at the moment is there seems to be some kind of modus vivendi that actually the Pakistani authorities and the U.S., certainly the U.S. command in Afghanistan or NATO forces in Afghanistan, seem to be at a place where they're happy with the Predator stuff and that's sort of where they are. A more serious incursion might well be destabilizing. It would depend on the circumstances in which it took place, how it was prepared in terms of public diplomacy. I mean, just it's too large a question to deal with on the whole. But I'd say, you wouldn't expect it to promote stability.
Yeah. Can I add something to that? That wouldn't be as fun.
Okay. I think maybe we need to think a little bit differently about sovereignty when dealing with the Middle East, including Pakistan. You know, if someone invaded, if a Mexican gang invaded Arizona, right, and took 2 miles from Arizona, this would be a major infringement on U.S. sovereignty. I mean, the same as invading New York City, as far as we're concerned. But there are areas throughout the Middle East which are nominally under the sovereignty of these, nation states, but for all intents and purposes, they're not under state control. And Pakistan certainly admits as much. These tribal areas have virtual autonomy. They're, lawless. as far as their own government is concerned. And so, you know, they, of course, they tell the media this is an infringement on our sovereignty and so forth, but sovereignty in many countries in the world is not an all or nothing thing. It, you know, some areas are under greater control of the central state than others, and usually this is kind of a center-periphery thing. So I'm not sure it would be entirely destabilizing because this area is already quite unstable and ungovernable as far as the central government is concerned.
30 seconds.
The issue of all politics as local comes to play here again because one of the things that Ed alluded to this, there are more than one interest group involved here, right? There is the interest group of those who are concerned with Pakistan as a state, sovereignty, that issue. A not inconsiderable part of the population. There are tribes who have no conception of where the border is, nor do they care. It hasn't mattered to them because half their relatives live here and half there, and some fool back in London drew a pencil line on a map and said, there's the border, and it has no meaning to them. And unless you've been there, you really can't understand how little meaning it actually has. So a strike across the border is in many ways a border that isn't recognized by the people who are being struck against. And their complaint isn't a violation of Pakistani sovereignty. It's, you're dropping bombs on my head, and I don't like you very much for that, thank you. And you're killing my cousins on the other side. There's also the issue of the military in Pakistan, which is itself split down the middle. I don't know if it's 50-50, but it's severely split between those who are concerned with the issue of a modern Pakistan state and those who are very much concerned with religious issues. And here I'm talking about a radical Islamist element within that military. And both of those are at war with one another on a daily basis.
Let me turn it over to James for the College Democrats. Get a quick question in.
Thank you.
Okay.
My name is James Liskett. I'm the president of the College Democrats. So a question for you, Professor Williams. Do you foresee either one of the candidates creating a standalone domestic intelligence service? And why or why not?
Wow. Boy, did you hit my hot button. The great reform of 2004 and the debate that never was. I doubt it seriously for political reasons, but to be perfectly candid with you, I wish to God it would happen, and I wish it wouldn't be a law enforcement agency. I wish that it would be an American version of MI5, which is now part of the Home Office in the UK. An organization that is responsible for collecting domestic intelligence and has no law enforcement authority whatsoever. If it chooses to take a law enforcement action, that organization has to go to Scotland Yard. And Scotland Yard, through the legal process in the UK, which is not all that dissimilar from ours, since ours is fundamentally based on the Anglo-Saxon system, Scotland Yard decides what action should or should not be taken in a law enforcement realm. Right? Many of the issues that we concern ourselves with in terms of civil liberties would be moderated. I didn't say go away, but would be moderated under that circumstance. It was an issue that was considered briefly in the 2004 reform and then tossed out the window. And it was tossed out the window primarily because of enormously successful lobbying on the part of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and its current head, Robert Mueller. So the short answer is I would be surprised, but God, you would all be well served if that were to happen and if the FBI were allowed to go back to being the premier law enforcement agency that it was and is fast unbecoming.
We're going to open this up to time for a few questions from the wider audience. Before we do, though, I want to thank the College Democrats and the College Republicans for coming tonight and also to extend our apologies. When you ask a faculty member to say his or her name, it often takes more than 7 minutes. So trying to cover huge regions of the world in that very short period of time is a difficult task. So thanks for being here, and our apologies. We couldn't make more use of you. I'm sure you had other very good questions.
Christopher Ladd, I'm a senior law and policy major. Something that's amazing is that we can sit here for an hour and a half and Africa doesn't come up. One candidate in this election is calling for immediate U.S. and U.N. intervention in Sudan. Could you please comment on the situation? And Professor Diamant, I'm sure you'll have something to add as far as China is concerned. Thank you.
Yeah, let's
no, I mean, if we were to add Africa, we would have been here for 3 hours. It's, you know, size is another problem there, too. Africa is marginalized. You know, it's marginalized in the academy. It's marginalized in our language instruction. And it's marginalized in U.S. foreign policy, too. And I think this is somewhat a reflection of this. You know, our faculty does not have someone who devotes his or her time specifically to the study of Africa. And, you know, historically, Africa has not been that important. It was more important during the Cold War when the U.S. and Russia were competing for the loyalties and resources of several African countries. But these days, you know, when so many problems are transnational, diseases, AIDS, and so forth, it's an area that's very hard to avoid. I think all U.S. presidents will have to deal with it in some way. And again, it's our regret that we don't have the time or the expertise even in our department to say anything extremely meaningful about it.
Before you go, I want to add something to that. This is by, I'm trying very hard to be nonpartisan in all of this, but I would point out that the current U.S. government has in administration has in fact created an Africa command. Historically, under the U.S. military command structure, Africa was a problem for the European command. It is no longer a problem for the European command. There is an independent African command that holds the same, whose commander holds the same rank and has the same basic authority within the command structure as CENTCOM and PACOM and UCOM and so forth. That's a non-trivial change in American policy. It means a great deal of resources that were formerly not available under any individual who had an interest. Now those resources are available, and there is an individual very senior in the U.S. military structure, at least, that has an interest in properly using those resources. I would also point out to you that the current U.S. government has, by anyone's measure, very much taken the lead in trying to treat issues such as HIV in Africa. You're spending your tax monies on that to a degree that were never spent before. A third point, if you enjoyed Iraq, you're going to love humanitarian intervention in Darfur. Ponder that, because it is every bit as difficult and every bit as complex, and it will be every bit as expensive in treasure and blood.
Maybe two more questions. Yeah, back there.
I've heard a lot of different threats and issues that you think are important. What do you think is the single most important immediate threat that the next administration should immediately tackle? And that's for any or all.
Anybody want to take that one?
I gave my answer. Prioritizing American national interests and developing a coherent strategy based around those priorities may not seem like a threat, but if you try to deal with these problems the way they appear to be dealt with too often, they all become threats immediately, and you can't deal with any of them. Yeah.
I think that the issue, I used to work as a diplomat too before, you know, this is my second job. I like this one better, actually. But you know, when you're inside government or when you're observing it from outside, you realize you can't parse the world out that way. You can't say, oh, there's the threat right there. Each one of these issues has so many different aspects to it. All these issues are competing for attention. Whoever sits in the Oval Office is going to be dealing with hundreds and hundreds of issues every day. And there's no way to say, oh, well, that's the one. If you get that one right, everything else will be, you know, will be fine. Extraordinary complexity, chaos even, that's the nature of international politics, politics in general, but particularly international politics. So I'm just going to challenge your question there. I don't think I can answer it.
Iraq is an excellent example of that. I mean, sure. You know, trying to address the terrorist issue in Afghanistan And then addressing, and I will just stop there and let you fill in the blank, addressing whatever issue the administration chose to address in Iraq. But one of the unintended consequences that Ed's talking about is that Iran all of a sudden found itself moving from being supportive of American policy in Afghanistan to being absolutely unsupportive of American policy in the Middle East, because it now had an American army on both its eastern and western frontiers. You know, there is a crisis that was created through the law of unintended consequences and a very bad understanding of strategy.
I think I saw a question back there.
It'd be great to hear, if possible, some general ideas or comments about the relationship between the U.S. and Latin America with the next president. Thank you.
So people are asking about areas of the world that we're not expertise on.
There is a very good article in the latest journal edition of Foreign Affairs by Jorge Castaneda. I recommend you read it. He addresses this question, and he sees, to use Christine's term, enormous opportunities for the next administration, if that administration is prepared to make some adjustments in attitude, and that gets to doing the hard work of generating popular support in the Congress and in the part of the population for some of these solutions.
I mean, I would also challenge kind of your question, because, you know, there are lots of countries there. And, you know, our relationship with Venezuela is not the same as Brazil or Peru or, you know, Uruguay. There are different issues affecting each of these countries. And, you know, God forbid we have one policy for the whole continent. I don't think that would be particularly smart.
We're going to have to cut it off at this point. I want to thank the panelists for their participation tonight. I want to thank the audience for attending. And we have Catherine from the Clark Forum who is going to close things up for us tonight.
The Clark Forum would especially like to thank the Political Science Department for sponsoring tonight's event and taking the lead in organizing it. This concludes our presentation. Thank you for attending.